just anybody.
Help!
You know I need someone.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. Bill Arnold with George Fraser at the controls tonight. Alex at the board.
Mm-hmm.
So far, so good. George, it's another evening where we will try to overestimate our own level of skill behind the microphones. We do that often. Every week we do it, George.
Yes.
We give it a shot, and you will discover at the end of this hour that either we have a tremendous amount of training or none at all.
Well, that's easy. None. We have a great guest tonight.
Though. We have a very exciting guest. Yes, we're going to get to that in just a minute. We're going to talk about step three in a little bit, and then we're going to introduce our guest who is calling in the studio from Philadelphia, I believe.
I like how we're talking like radio guys.
Well, I know. Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, we're both tired, George, and where we're trying to amp it up here a little bit.
Well, it's pretty warm out today. It took a lot out of me. What was it, 2?
15 below this morning when I got up.
Yeah.
George, did you not see that new Jesus movie this weekend?
I did see it.
And what'd you think?
Well, you know, I've read the book, and so I wasn't real shocked at how it turned out, but it was well done.
Was there no spoiler alert or anything? You just...
No, Jesus obviously is hitting the gym. He looked good.
Was he ripped?
Yeah, he's ripped.
Yeah, well, that's what happens.
Pontius Pilate is from Britain. That was good. It was a well-done movie. Did I just cost us a show?
Oh, I'm sure. The phones are lighting up.
Yeah. No, you know, it was really well done, and it was indoors, which in Minneapolis
that's enough.
Is good.
You're boring me, George. We're going to bring on in just a few minutes, because we're going to talk about step three, but our guest tonight, because I'm very excited, I got my hands on this book a while ago, we have Rona Epstein with us tonight. She's a licensed psychologist, certified addictions counselor, and marriage and family therapist. So, George, we have talent on the show tonight.
She's PsyD. That's pretty important.
What does PsyD mean?
It's like a doctorate.
Serious?
Yeah.
She's a doctor?
Yeah.
Oh. All right.
I think so. She can sit, but the same amount of education. So a lot smarter than we are, obviously.
Well, a lot smarter.
Let's hope.
Yeah, a lot smarter. And she's going to talk about her book, among other things. Her book is called Food Triggers, End Your Cravings, Eat Well, and Live Better. And this is a subject, George, that nearly everyone that's listening to this radio show tonight may struggle with. You know, when we talk about drugs or alcohol or some of the other addictions, that may not touch everyone's base, but this one... This ball is going right down the middle of the alley.
Absolutely.
We're going to knock a lot of pins over tonight.
Well, I think that obesity is the acceptable sin of the evangelical community. And I think all of us struggle with food. I know for me, being in recovery from alcohol, drugs, tobacco, that I had to do the food thing too. Because we want things to change how we feel. We like that. And foods, I ate like I drank. You know, it's like my dog Buster. You put it in front of me, it's going to be gone. And I think a lot of us do that. We eat a lot when we get home from work to reward ourselves. Now, every week we talk about a step on here, and tonight it's step three, where we make a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand Him. And on this radio program, we understand God to not be a higher power, Bill. We understand Jesus Christ as the highest power.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're out there and you're in a 12-step program and you've changed a behavior, congratulations. Abstinence is a good thing, but you need to develop a relationship with the Creator and Savior of the universe, and that's only found through Jesus Christ. And so tonight we're going to talk about turning our whole life over to Him. Bill, if Jesus is going to be my Savior, He needs to be Lord over all areas of my life. And for me, I struggle with lust, greed, fear, food. You know, you name it, I got it. And I think most of us do that. And it's kind of like when you go to that pizza place where they have the Bear Band, Chuck E. Cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And
I don't really know about that,
George.
That's where you're losing me.
You hit that whack-a-mole thing. You know, you knock down one sin and another one comes up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what happens. And the last one for most of us is food.
Okay. Well, Rona's going to be our expert tonight, and you know, addictive drugs like cocaine and heroin stimulate the parts of the brain that register pleasure and relief.
Sounds like you're reading that.
Yeah, exactly what I'm doing
okay,
as I'm reading.
Okay, because I know you. You're not that smart. You read that. That's kind of like me. I'm reading,
I'm
too.
Reading the back of Rona's book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I'm giving her credit.
Just don't throw it at me. We should
you're
do a show
you're
on
pushing
anger.
It. No, we'll do a show on anger next week.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll be
in the hospital.
Right. Me and the team of monkeys will write the questions for next week.
Do you think our first addiction for a lot of us, Bill, is sugar?
I think so. I mean, we go to the corner drugstore and buy Pixie Sticks, which is just a tube of sugar.
I remember those.
Remember those?
Oh, yeah.
Those were good. So, George, let's talk about step three and let's get run on the air because it's time.
Okay.
So talk about step three.
Well, step three is turning our life and our will over to the care of God. Idolatry is our problem, and basically what it is egocentrism. I want to be God. I want to do what I want to do when I want to do it, and I want to do it right now, and I want to do a lot of it. That's the first commandment, too. We shall have no other gods before God, and we put ourselves above him. Anytime I sin, Bill, I'm choosing to do my will rather than God's will. And it's all about us, and to get off us is hard. And I think we eat that way, too. I'm supposed to nourish my body, but I want to, you know, do what I want to do, and I want to feel good. So this is going to be a great topic tonight. I think we should need to get her on now.
Well, George, I will do that then. I will introduce our guest, Rona Epstein. She is, like I said, a licensed psychologist, certified addictions counselor, marriage and family therapist. She has personally experienced recovery from food addiction, and she's been busy helping individuals find freedom over food addiction for the past 25 years. Welcome to the show, Dr. Epstein.
Well, hi. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And she's still here.
She didn't hang up after our intro. Thank you.
I am still here. I'm enjoying listening to you. You guys, you're funny.
Oh. Rona, let's start talking right away about food addiction. And are there certain properties, certain foods, and can they sort of mix with our personal chemistry and our brain and just cause problems right from the get-go?
Well, that's what the research is saying today, and there's more and more evidence of it. So the thing about food that's tricky is that, like with drugs and alcohol, I don't think we really know, like, why does one person become an alcoholic and another person prefers cocaine or marijuana? I mean, they're all hitting the pleasure centers, but for different reasons, we go to different drugs. But with food, I don't know. There seems like sugar and white flour are the druggy foods for most people. I mean, people who really struggle with food addiction, overeating, seem to get really caught up there. And the research is sort of more on the sugar and white flour, refined carbohydrates. But actually, in my practice, I see and hear stories of people who binge on savory foods and salty, fatty foods. And so I think that we're still only learning about how food addiction, chemically can really happen. I think the evidence is clear in the research that sugar and refined carbohydrates can actually be addictive like drugs. And there's more and more evidence coming out about the other foods. So we're still learning about some of this.
The question I have for you is, a kid growing up in the 1960s, I'd get good breakfast every day of some Welch's grape juice, maybe some sugar crisp cereals, and some cocoa. And I believe, right, for me, you know, then you put me in front of the TV and the long term isn't good. You should see it. But the thing is, I think my first addiction was sugar. There's a real spike in that, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm glad that you said that, because I really believe that's true, that a lot of people who struggle with addictions, that if you do their history, you'll come back to that and you'll see that sweets really is where it started. And you'll oftentimes see people, when they get in recovery from drugs and alcohol, they will find themselves turning back to food and needing help for that as well. So as a matter of fact, even just this past week, a guy came to see me who actually was a cocaine addict. And he, too, was the same as you, that, you know, sugar was his thing as a kid. But then, you know, 12 years of cocaine abuse and the sugar kind of got put on hold. And now he's in my office saying, I am just as bad with the sugar as I was with the cocaine.
I get that.
So sugar is a pretty serious drug. There's no question.
Yeah, well, actually, the studies are saying it's actually more addictive than cocaine.
Never done well with white powders in any form, you know. So, but gosh, you know, that would make sense, because growing up, you know, there was the Kool-Aids and all these things and candy. And Bill was talking about Pixie Sticks. It just kind of fit our lifestyle, and it was a great reward, too.
Yes. I don't think we knew. I mean, even today, it's still hard for people who are trying to do the right thing. Everybody else's kids are eating treats. And if the parents try to help their kids to eat healthy, they feel deprived and it's not fair and everybody else is having it. And we're just really learning about these issues now. I hope in the generations to come that people will be a little smarter about what they're feeding their kids. Because I was the same as you. I was eating Captain Crunch for breakfast and Pop-Tarts. And I don't remember, those pastas in the cans, you know, for lunch, and you know, just all white flour and sugar.
I loved Captain Crunch.
Right, I could eat a whole box.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, go ahead, Billy.
No, go ahead, George.
Well, I'm just wondering how this starts in your usual client. You know, what's the average age, if there is one, of somebody who comes to you, and what's their background?
Well, actually, I see people mostly. I work mostly with adults, but when I do a history on a person, you were right about the age, because the preoccupation with food and the struggles with overeating starts really young. And 5 or 6 years old, I hear stories of people who are already hiding and sneaking, stealing candy, just really kind of being preoccupied and abusing it. And then, of course, some of the clients that have heartbreaking stories of being overweight and being teased and just turning more and more to the food to handle the social rejection that they're feeling. So this can really start young. And, of course, it's not at all uncommon for teenagers to be completely out of control by the time they're even 13 or 14 years old.
Well, Ronnie, when you brought up social rejection, I promised George we wouldn't talk about him tonight. So we're going to take a very short break, and I'll need to apologize to him during the break. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill Arnold and George Fraser. We're talking to Dr. Rona Epstein tonight, and you're in for a great hour. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Bill Arnold, George Fraser. It's 5:17 Sunday night. Thanks for joining us. We're glad you're with us. It's still cold. It's still winter. We're talking tonight to Dr. Rona Epstein. She is a licensed psychologist. And in the introduction of her book about her personal story, she starts with Psalm 40, verse 2. And if I may read it, "He brought me up out of a pit of destruction, out of the miry clay. And he set my feet upon a rock, making my footsteps firm." I just love that. And Ron, I'm real interested in hearing your faith story. I mean, your story of recovery from sugar.
Okay.
Are you ready for that?
I'm ready if you're ready.
No, we're ready.
Okay. Well, let's see. What can I tell you? Feel free to jump in and ask me questions, because there's many parts of the story. So
okay, let's start when you were like in high school, and you realized that your proclivity towards sugar, let me use that word again, George, was starting to get a little out of control. And how was it affecting your social world, and how were you using it in your life?
Okay, well, high school is when I hit bottom, so actually that was the worst part for me. And I always had a problem with food from the time I was little, but it was really not obvious. It wasn't really destroying my life until I got into high school. And from the time I was about 13 or 14 until I was 17, it was just a progressive problem that got worse and worse every single year. So there was a kind of a combination of things going on. One, of course, there's all this obsession with weight. So, of course, I'm overeating, and I'm worried about my weight at the same time. So there's like a double obsession, one with food and the other with my weight. And I was able to manage my weight by doing diets between my binges. So I would starve and then binge and then starve and then binge. And like a good alcoholic who kind of starts out drinking only on the weekends, like, you know, and it creeps into a little bit in the evenings, and then it creeps into you're in the morning. That's sort of the way it went with me for food. It just got worse and worse and worse, so that the diets were failing and I felt like a failure, and I was really, the binging was getting so out of control that I couldn't keep up with it with the starvation diets. And so I started putting weight on and getting depressed and wanting to die. And I'm telling you, I could, by the time I was at my bottom, I mean, I my whole day was being ruined by this, because I was either thinking about food or trying to get rid of it. And so I was eating half gallons of ice cream in secret and replacing them, trying to pretend like the top of it was, you know, the same as it was before I polished off the whole half gallon. And I'd eat peanut butter out of a jar with a spoon. And I purged. I took amphetamines to try to curb my appetite, but of course that didn't really help too well since I was also smoking pot. But it's kind of messed up. It really took over my life. And I was trying. I mean, you couldn't necessarily know if you met me. I kind of looked like I was covering it all up with, having a fairly active social life. And people didn't really know I wanted to die, and they didn't know that this was going on because I did not, you know, binge and eat in front of people. So I would act like I was on a diet in front of everybody else. And then when I got alone is when it would be in secret, binging out of control. And then in my thoughts, of course, was nothing but self-hatred. I thought I was fat, and I thought that I was worthless. And it was pretty bad, to the point where every day I had wishes to die. That's how bad it got.
Rona, was that the drama of a teenager, a high school teenager, or did you really want to die?
I really wanted to die.
Okay.
I mean, I never expressed this to anybody. But I couldn't stand the way I was living because I was so out of control, and it was such a double life. I'm smiling in front of everybody else and not looking like I'm having fun with people and looking normal. And I have this thing going on. And at the time, I graduated high school in 1981. So at that time, I was bulimic, and you didn't know that word was not one we knew.
Right.
So nobody knew about binging and purging and secretive been eating. I mean, it was like, I was like, you know, crazy. Just crazy.
Do you get a high out of that? I mean, what do we get out of the binging and purging? There's got to be a physiological response or something out of that. What is that?
Well, it numbs you. I mean, it's numbing. See, the overeating is numbing. It numbs emotions. I'm sure that all the life, just like that's what I see with people who I work with. And, when you start to pull the excess food out, I mean, what you see is all these unresolved, numbed out feelings start popping up. And you find out what was under there all along, which all have been, but like I think that's true of all addictions, is that they serve to provide an escape. And so instead of thinking about the fact that you feel rejected, like for me, you know, there was experiences of rejection at home and the stress of school and not feeling confident in different ways. And of course, none of that gets dealt with at all because I'm too busy thinking about what I'm eating, what I'm not eating, and how I look. And that's taking up all my attention. So it's a great escape and a great numbing experience. And it works. That's why people cry in my office when they start thinking about not using food anymore. And they start to think, well, what am I going to do? How will I cope? Because that's been the way of coping.
You know, Bill, it's real refreshing to hear that. I work with a lot of drug addicts. I'm a licensed alcohol drug counselor. And
yeah, you know what? She's a doctor. No, Rona 1, George 0.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
No, but that's what I'm saying.
I know. But you're a comedian, so we're expecting some material here. But here's where I want to go with this, Billy, is there's a reason people do what they do. They get something out of it. And the guys we work with don't want to lose the positive thing they get, even though there's some big destruction. And we don't hear this a lot, doctor, and I'm glad you're sharing that, because the perception it's not working, they don't want to give up the part that does work, even though it's killing
them.
And that's a big point you made. And that's got to be, how do you get through that with your clients?
Well, that's the worst part. I mean, we sit and cry together. I'm telling you, it's like people start crying, like, oh, I can't have sugar anymore. It's really bad. I mean, because they just, they don't know. They were like, how will I live? It's like taking away a blankie from a little kid who's attached to their blankie. It's just.
That hurt me more than it was intended, I'm sure, but I get that. Bill, we run into that all the time with guys that are doing so well, and all of a sudden they throw everything away because they want to get high again. It's very powerful, isn't it?
It's very powerful. And that's why, I mean, what I run an intensive outpatient program where people come 4 days a week, and you know, like a drug and alcohol program. And the early months are torturous for people because they just can't. If you think about it, if a person started numbing out their feelings when they were 5 or 6, and now they're like 35 or 40 or 50, and they've never coped without their comfort numbing agent before, now we're taking it away. And we say this in drug and alcohol treatment. You might say, I don't know if you in your neck of the woods, but here where I grew up as a counselor, we say you're emotionally however old you were when you started your addictions. So if that's true, then we've got a person who is a grown woman or man who it has the emotional capacity of a child. And it is so uncomfortable that that's why people, you're exactly right, why people can't tolerate life without it. Because it takes time to get through the discomfort and to learn how to cope without something numbing you. It takes time, and it's hard work. It's hard work because it's intense and difficult. People are very overwhelmed with what's happening inside of them. It's so uncomfortable, and I do think that's the reason why relapse is such a problem.
You've completely explained my co-host. I will send you $1,000.
Well, no, there's something wrong with that theory, though, Billy. It's like the age you started using at, you know, that's where you stop maturing, but then you'd add the years of sobriety onto that.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way I'm like a 40-year-old. You know that. That's not true. I agree with that 100%. The hard thing, doctor, about eating is, okay, if a guy's an alcoholic, we don't have to drink, but you need to eat every day to stay alive. How do you
that?
And so it's almost like controlled use then, isn't it?
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
I mean, we start, listen, I haven't eaten sugar, you know, sweets, for 31 years. And, you know, for me, that's my drug of choice. I don't need that to live. I don't need to eat ice cream and cake. I don't need to eat cookies. I have no, they're nutritionally useless. So, you know, it's just like, you know, you have to drink, but you don't have to drink alcohol. And I don't care whether it's the summer and you're sitting on the beach. You know, you don't, yeah. You know, if you're an alcoholic and you end up in blackouts when you drink, you need to face that you can't drink. A food addict needs to face, and that's what the title, Food Triggers, you know, what are the foods that are getting them into trouble? And then abstinence for a food addict would look like abstaining. Now, this is something, it's a controversial issue in the eating disorders field. They don't believe in abstinence, and most treatment centers are trying to teach people how to kind of grow up emotionally and still and deal with their underlying issues and manage the food in moderation. In when I work with people who are self-proclaimed food addicts, people who have been through 5, 6 treatments and they're still binging, I'm going to say to them, okay, did you ever try abstinence? Of course they haven't, because this is still breaking news that you can actually be addicted. And so, but when I work with a person, we say, okay, let's take a look at what are you binging on? And we need to get rid of those foods. And then we need to make a plan. And we need to put boundaries around how we eat. So for me, and for, I have a nutritionist that works with us, and she's great. She understands food addiction. So everybody's different. That's where it kind of, everybody's sensitivity is different. Everybody is addicted to different things, the way they use, I mean, for one person, something might be perfectly fine to eat. Another person, they couldn't eat it without binging. And so you have to kind of learn from each individual what's going to be the right plan for them. But, you know, I eat 3 meals and 2 snacks every day. And I stick with using the same basic portions so that I make sure I always have what I need, none of that dieting stuff. You know, I always have to make sure I have what I need. I can't let myself go hungry because that's a trigger. You get, you know, people may think, oh, I want to hurry up and lose weight. And then they starve themselves and then they end up binging because they're starving. So you can't, like, that's another side of it. It has to be, like, healthy eating and learning whole foods and making sure to eat things. Everything counts so that when you eat, it's actually nourishing your body and it's filling you up so you're good and satisfied when you eat, and you won't be really needing to binge when you do that. And then, that, you know, of course, once a person kind of faces that, you know, I admit I'm powerless and I need help, facing the fact of, yeah, I can't just go into my house and start or go to a party and just eat whatever I want. I need to stay with my structure and turn this over to God, just like you would any other addiction. Turning over, you know, facing and surrendering that, you know, every time I eat cookies, you know, I binge. Well, you know, I give, you know, no more cookies.
Yeah, Rona, on page 122 of your book, Food Triggers, there's a line that says, the cookie in hand will always win.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So based on that, we're going to take a very short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about that a little bit and more with Dr. Rona Epstein. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill Arnold and George Fraser on Faith Radio. We'll be back in a minute. Thanks for being with us tonight.
And his hand fell behind her as his arm had reached around.
Welcome back, everybody, to Real Recovery. Bill Arnold and George Fraser. We are having a wonderful conversation tonight with Dr. Rona Epstein. She is calling and talking about her book, Food Triggers, and also her story, her life. We just left off. We were talking about the cookie in hand will always win. And, Rona, earlier on in the interview, you had talked about sort of not liking the body you were dragging around and feeling like you had an eating problem and a weight problem. And how do you get back to loving the body that you carry around that you used to not like or still don't like?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, it's an interesting question. Good question.
Thank you. Alex, make a note of that, that I asked that
Bill,
one.
Bill got an interesting question. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Well,
yeah,
I know.
No, that's for sure. We don't keep score around here, Rona, just so you know.
1-0.
Yeah, it's definitely 1-0.
Yeah,
it's one of these things that actually, you know, believe it or not, it's the crazy thing about the body image stuff that goes on for people is that the despair and the depression around what we look like actually triggers overeating, because you know you look in the mirror and say, oh, I look terrible, and then of course you feel bad, so then you use food to make yourself feel better.
Yep.
It's quite paradoxical the way that works, and actually that's
whatever that word means.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I actually often recommend to people getting off the scale and getting away from picking at themselves in the mirror and really, you know, just not getting caught up in numbers and all that. This is a whole, I do a bunch of different exercises with clients and all, but for me, I'll talk about myself for a moment. I mean, I really, really hated myself. And of course, I look back at my pictures and I'm like, I didn't look nearly as bad as I thought, but I really had an image of myself in the mirror that was just horrible. And I think the beginning of change, and you know, you'll hear people say, oh, I have to say nice affirmations, but most of my clients, including myself, that doesn't work. You're not ready to say nice things because you really, really do believe that you're fat and ugly. And for some people, they are. I mean, not ugly, but you know, I'm saying people can be very obese. I work with people who are 300 pounds or more, who've been up and down the scale and who are pretty heavy. And so, you know, it's true. I mean, what you're seeing is true. And for some of us, we're making big deals over, you know, 10 pounds, or maybe we have a perfectly good body, but we just, to ourselves, think we're fat. And of course, if we're overeating, we feel puffy and we might be bloated, and that can make you feel fat too. But this can be a whole obsession. So, I mean, ideally, it would be nice to be able to make friends with your body, to say nice things and to be able to affirm. But sometimes in the beginning, I think the key is to start neutralizing some of that negative picking, sort of bullying talk in your mind. And I do recommend starting with kind of just changing the subject, like, you know, get off the negative self-talk channel and put yourself onto some other station, because there's other things you could be thinking about that you don't have to get up in the morning and pick. You know, it's just deciding to change your mind, because you can't really, if we ask ourselves the questions like, what value is there? What benefit is there in spending time picking on the way you look? How does it help you in any way, spending even 1 minute saying, oh, look at you, you're just fat and disgusting? Unless it's motivating you to change, then there's no point in it. It only makes you feel bad. So the goal would be eventually to make friends. My favorite exercise that I give to people is to write like a dialogue, like pick a part of your body that you hate. Like for me, my belly was the part that I hated the most because I have a tummy that kind of sticks out. And we all have those parts that we wish were different. And, you know, to write like, hey, dear stomach, I hate you. Stick out. You make all my clothes look bad. Why can't you be flat? And then have your stomach write back, you know, dear Rona, why are you so mean to me? Right? Why, do you know what it makes me feel like when you curse me and put me down? Do you realize that if you wouldn't be able to digest your food if it wasn't for me? And then you talk back and you go back and forth. And the goal at the end of the exercise is to apologize to your body for being so unkind and to make a commitment and a pact that you're not going to do that anymore. You're going to act and think lovingly. And in fact, actually, I do believe that by doing that and beginning to quit that negative attitude, it starts to empower you, feel better. And actually, that can even help you want to eat better because you feel better.
I get that. I think it's very important, Bill, whenever we change a behavior to reinforce the positive changes because otherwise we lose hope. And I'm thinking, Doctor, that back in high school when you were going to kill yourself, that the hope is gone at that point. What happened? What turned that around?
Well, somehow, and I will only say that today I would say it had to be that God was leading me because I was so ready to quit. I had tried all these methods of control, all these diets, and nothing was working. And I really... of course, it wasn't working because I was doing the diets in front of everybody and, you know, of course, binging in secret. And I couldn't make it through a day. I couldn't keep a diet for a day. And I really had lost hope. And actually, I remember my parents were going to pay for some diet program that I was about to think about starting. And as we were about to sign up, I told my mom, forget it. Because I knew I knew I was kidding myself. Like, I think it was like my point of facing that I'm done. It's useless. Like, don't spend your money. And soon after that, I actually met somebody who was in a recovery group who had lost weight and really had changed. Like, there was like a total change in this person's whole countenance, their whole personality. Not only had we lost weight, but there was a peacefulness, just a change. And I don't even know why I asked, because I was really done trying at 17, senior in high school. And this person said they went to this recovery group and told me where it was. I never saw the person, FYI, at the group. But I went, and I was there, you know, and I found help. And these people were talking about the same. They had the same story I did. I found out I wasn't alone, that there were other people who struggle and who can't stop eating, who were throwing food in the trash and swearing it off and then pulling it out of the trash because, you know, they couldn't keep their hands off of it. And that's so shameful. And people admitted that out loud. So I knew that I came to the right place and there was hope there. And eventually, you know, it led me to finding faith in the it was the love of other people when I hated myself, and they were very loving to me. No one rejected me. Everybody, there was an understanding and a sense of belonging. And then, you know, there was a spiritual basis to this recovery group, and it led me to a relationship with God, which then changed my whole life completely. So that's the short version.
How did that happen? How did the principles of this group lead you to God?
Well, I tried just going to the group and controlling my food, and that wasn't working. Like, just having the support was not enough. And people who I thought were doing very well, who obviously had real changes in their lives, they talked about God, and they encouraged me to start praying and reading spiritual literature. And I was raised Jewish, and I really didn't find much personal satisfaction in my, I mean, it was nice from a social standpoint to be culturally Jewish, like, you know, eating bagels and, you know, having the holidays and being Jewish. And where I grew up, it was, you know, a lot of my friends were, and it was a cultural thing, but not at all spiritual. There was nothing personal about it. It wasn't like I prayed personally. I just had like ritual routines that I learned. But, you know, I was encouraged to start talking to God, telling him my concerns, asking for my help with my eating. And then I was encouraged to start reading spiritual readings, like little daily meditation books. And I started talking to different people about what they did. How did they practice faith? How did they understand? And I wrestled. It took me 2.5 years to stop eating. And then I will tell you honestly, it was 5 years before I stopped obsessing about food and my body. That's how long this process was for me. But the whole thing was about, like you said, step three, about turning my life over. In the end, it was really about finding a relationship with God and his love and not trying to fix this. And that's kind of a crazy thing. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to, you know, naturally think I have to discover the answers and work this out. And actually, the whole thing was really about turning everything over to God, not just my eating problem, but everything, my emotional pain, my days, how I spent them, you know, my character issues. There were so many things that I needed help with besides food, you know, just fear and insecurity and all the body image stuff. It all needed to be turned over. And that was quite a process. And it goes on. It's an unending process. But it really, the breakthrough for me with regards to the whole thing really being lifted was really, I had a miraculous surrender moment, actually. And that's not in my book because they pulled that out of my book. But I had a really miraculous moment with God where the whole obsession, everything was lifted in this prayer time where God revealed to me that, it was not even about me at all. It was really that God wanted to fill my heart with his love. And that's when I need to concentrate my attention on not everything else, not all of the things about me that are wrong and trying to find the deep, dark secrets and clean them all out and make sure I have myself all straight and then this thing will go away. It was actually like God wanted to show me he loves me. And once I became aware that was really what was missing all along, and that was the answer, and that was the end of it.
So it's about building a relationship with God and not stopping a behavior.
Yes.
Well, we're going to take a very short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about that some more. Dr. Rona Epstein, we're so glad you joined us tonight on Real Recovery. It is 5:45. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Real Recovery, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Bill Arnold with George Fraser. We're talking about food addictions and this whole thing is making me hungry. George, after the show, you are buying me dinner, and I'm ordering an appetizer as well as an entree.
We do that every week. I buy you dinner
week. But I don't get the appetizer. I'm getting it this time, this tonight.
Oh, no.
Because all this talk has made me very hungry. Rona, we want to jump a little bit more into your faith story because, you know, you're raised in a Jewish family, and now all of a sudden you're talking about a faith conversion, and how was Jesus involved in that?
Well, I tried to find God every other possible way that a person could, because I did not want to believe in Jesus. That actually, for me, would mean potentially losing every important person in my life. Being Jewish and believing in Jesus is a huge deal for Jewish people. They feel people get very angry at people who believe in Jesus. You could believe in anything, but you cannot believe in Jesus if you're Jewish. Now, of course, I know that's not true today because I am a Messianic Jew, and there's a lot of people who are Jewish that believe in Jesus, but it's not very popular amongst secular Jews. I mean, people who, like my family. And so I tried on all kinds of prayer and meditation options, and readings and various things. And so, all the time, everything, I just always felt in my heart, this is not right. It's not the right path. It's not the right path. It's not the right path. And I still felt like I was just hungry for this spiritual solution that I believed was the answer. I wasn't finding it. And then I started visiting people's churches and started to actually had a good friend of mine who also was in recovery from food addiction, was a strong Christian, and told me, you know, Rona, the chances of you ever really getting better without turning your life to Jesus, you know, it's probably, you know, at this point, I mean, I was desperate. I was so messed up. And she just said, that's an option. I should consider it. I'm sort of like, okay, well, I'm at this point, it was pure desperation that I opened myself up there. And I just said a prayer and asked the Lord into my heart. And then it was a long time after that before I found anything like a spiritual home. I was resistant, but I was trying, you know, visiting churches and sitting there wondering, why, God, would you make me Jewish and then change that? You know, even a pastor that I spoke to said, well, you really need to think about this because the Jewish people are God's chosen people, and you just really need to make sure you're making the right decision, you know, about changing that. And I never felt quite right about it, but I did believe that Jesus was the Messiah. And so I actually was listening to Christian radio in secret. I, like, didn't tell anybody. I'd listen to Charles Stanley, like, almost every day. And I just, by myself, like, no one knew. I was like, I didn't know anybody else who was Jewish who believed in Jesus. It was really challenging, but at some point I was going to go back to synagogue, and I like opened the telephone book and looked up try to find a synagogue you can go to on the Jewish high holidays without paying for tickets. And you have to pay on the high holidays, you know? And, I saw this thing that said Messianic synagogue, and that was in 1987. And I ended up, going into this place, and I knew right away, I can't believe that these people were actually Jewish and they believed in Jesus. And I wasn't the only one in the whole world. It was the first time I ever met anybody else. They were actually really, really Jewish.
You felt at home for the first time, huh?
For the first time in all that time I had been in church, I was like, okay, well, this makes sense, but there's something wrong here. Like, I just culturally didn't fit. And then I walked in, I'm like, wow, this is amazing. Like, these people did not stop being Jewish. They're still Jewish, just like Jesus was Jewish, and so were the disciples. And they didn't quit being Jewish because they, you know, what was going on. They were, I consider Messianic Judaism, we call it completed Jew, you know. So as opposed to like, you know, you're now not Jewish and now you're a Christian, you can see it as more of a completion.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
That is a great story. God allows our addictions, I think, doctor, and shortcomings to get our attention. And on this program, we hear more and more people coming to faith because they finally just were at the end and, okay, I'm just going to give up, and Jesus shows up. In your practice, do you see the process of failure after failure after failure getting people to Jesus? And do you encourage them that way? Can you do that in your practice?
Well, I do. I mean, obviously, you know, I do. I'm admitting it on the air. Yes, I do. I think they tell you in school not to do that, but I do. Of course, people come where they are, and so there's no pressure from me on how that a person experiences God. I just encourage people to get on a spiritual journey.
Mm-hmm.
I recommend the 12-step programs to people, and while they're there, they're reading spiritual things, and of course, I walk through their exploration with them. One of the things that happens a lot as I'm running groups is a lot of the people who tend to come to me are Christians, because that's how they get referred to me, because Christians refer their Christian friends to me. And so my groups end up having Christians, and then the group members, they encourage the ones who don't know the Lord to, you know, to consider faith practices. And there's no pressure from it. I mean, people start where they are, just like I did. I mean, nobody could have told me when I first started a spiritual journey that I'm going to be, you know, become a Messianic Jewish believer and be talking on the radio with a bunch of Christians. You know, if they told me that, I would have ran for the hills. So it was good that I was able to take it piecemeal, you know, start with just trying on the idea of prayer, and then little by little realizing God's presence in these little meditations, and then step by step. Obviously, for some people, it's a little, you know, it could be quicker. Sometimes spiritual experiences happen quick, and sometimes they happen more slowly.
Rhonda, what was it like talking to your parents about this? Or haven't you yet?
Oh, yeah. That was challenging. Actually, at the time, I was quite young, so I was afraid. I wasn't quite ready to be on my own completely, even though I was finished school and whatnot. I still didn't feel particularly strong about being self-sufficient, and I was expecting actually to be cast out of the family. But I think my parents at first probably thought it was just some phase I was going through, and they didn't really have much to say about it, though I was shaken heading in that direction. But I mean, it took me a long time to get the guts up to and some therapy, actually. Actually, my Jewish therapist, who wasn't even a believer, told me I had to tell them because I couldn't keep on keeping the secret because it was hurting me. And I opened up, but it wasn't until actually I went to have a wedding and was going to invite all the Jewish family members to the wedding that my parents then got the anti-missionaries out and started to get propaganda from anti-missionaries to get me to change my mind, and they were threatening not to have the family come to the wedding and all this. So, but we got through it. We got through it, and now there's they're not, they haven't come to the Lord, but there's they've met all my friends and they've been to my community, and they know that we're not the crazy people that they suspected that we might be. That there's lots of lovely, wonderful believers that we worship with, and they can see for themselves that they're they used to say, oh, they prey on young people, and you're a young, impressionable person, and they're, just trying to get your money, and that's the way my father was talking to me.
Mm-hmm.
It was very scary. I really thought for sure that my relationship, but it is sad for me, though, being the only believer in my family.
Yeah. Well, it's,
I wish that were different.
Yeah, you are so interesting, and your book is so interesting, and if you ever wanted to be co-host of a radio show on addiction, I think I can make that happen.
Well,
I can talk to George after the show.
Billy, you're not going to quit the show?
No, I think you will be quitting the show. Yeah, we only have a few minutes left, maybe four, and what I would really like to ask you, Rhonda, is there behavior changes that people can start tonight or take action on? I mean, I don't have junk food in my house, so I can't binge on stuff that's not around. I always say to the guys that I work with in recovery, your feet are very important because where your feet are is where the rest of your body's going to be. So
if
your feet's in a store buying the most sugary foods in the world, you're probably going to end up putting them in your body. So what do you say for behavior modification just to get people started?
Well, I think you all know that behavior modification is only as helpful, if you really have a problem, you need to start praying to God for Him to deliver you and set you free.
Bingo.
Because, apart from that, it's just another self-will diet attempt. And I think, to face powerlessness, to face and admit before God, I can't do this, is the first place to start in the heart and in the mind, to recognize that I've tried everything and like this really is not working. And I really need the power of God to move here. So I would say that's the most important thing. Behaviorally, absolutely start looking at, you're right. I don't keep it in my house. If other people in my family want to have stuff, they can, get what they want, but just don't be keeping it around. And that is one thing. And there's always, if a person needs help, then there's help. Go get help. Go to a 12-step program. Overeaters Anonymous, for example, there's phone meetings you can get on any time of the day. You go on their website, and you can access a meeting almost any time of the day by phone. Some of these meetings get like 250 people from all over the country. And, get help. Get other people who have been there, who know their way around the recovery process, and let people in. And don't think you can do it alone, because with this kind of problem, because you do have to eat, you need help. People can't, we need a face, that we need accountability and support and people to hold our hand while we let go of these things that are killing us.
Temptation stalks you every day, doesn't it? I mean, not you personally, but... as we go out in the world.
It doesn't bother me anymore. I don't have to buy food anymore. That went away. But
I was I wasn't referring to you, but I'm saying temptation for people. I think is every day. It's
yes,
because we all have to eat.
That's right, and that's why you need in the beginning of change, you need a lot of support.
Yeah.
A lot of, I mean, as much time and if you think about all the time and energy that goes into the eating and the hiding and the sneaking and the lying and then the diet, and then you think about you have to now throw that type of energy into overcoming it.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't want to do that. We want to, that's why we just keep going for an easy, quick fix, but that only does like a Band-Aid, another diet, you lose some weight, people going up and down the scale. But to put your whole self into a transformation, that requires, you know, as much energy as it took into in your addiction. You got to put it into your recovery.
Right. Rona, thank you so much. I hate to cut you short, but we're going to be off the air here in a second. The book is called Food Triggers. The author is Rona Epstein. Thank you so much for joining us tonight on Real Recovery. We can't wait to have you back. Would you come back?
Thank you. Of course.
Perfect.
I would love to.
Perfect.
Thanks, Rona. You were great.
Good night, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you so much.